Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Democratic rebuttal to the Nunes memo and speak with Robert Litt, the former general counsel for the Director of National Intelligence, who is now with Morrison & Foster National Security and Global Risk and Crisis Management Practices. He joins us to discuss whether our intelligence agencies will continue to confide in Congress and the increasing pressure that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is bringing to bear on Paul Manafort, whose business partner Rick Gates is now cooperating with Mueller. We will assess whether Manafort will break under the mounting pressure of spending decades in prison or hang tough and fall on his sword for Trump in the hope of a presidential pardon, and examine the reasons why Rick Gates lied to Mueller as recently as February the 1st after his proffer to make a deal in an apparent attempt to cover up for the Kremlin-friendly Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who Gates met but lied about the 2013 meeting. Then we'll look further into the Democratic memo from the minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee and the extent to which it reflects a total breakdown of an oversight committee that was traditionally bipartisan. Locke Johnson, the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, who served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence and is the author of a new book just out, Spy Watching: Intelligence Accountability in the United States, joins us. We'll discuss Trump's Republican enablers' apparent willingness to destroy the DOJ and FBI in order to cover up for Trump and distract the public from the Russia investigation. Then finally, we'll look into Janus versus AFSCME case before the Supreme Court on Monday, which could strike a major blow to public sector unions and dry up Democratic Party funding before the 2018 midterm elections. With Janus predicted to win the case thanks to Neil Gorsuch, we'll speak with labor expert and University of California professor Dr. Harley Shaken about how this conservative assault could set a precedent for workers' invocation of the First Amendment to essentially free ride on unions without having to pay dues, as well as further limiting workers' bargaining rights like the restriction Scott Walker passed in Wisconsin in 2011. And joining us now is Bob Litt, a former general counsel for the Director of National Intelligence, who has also served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division of the Justice Department as a principal associate deputy attorney general, and he currently is counsel to Morrison & Foster's National Security and Global Risk and Crisis Management Practices. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Litt.
Thanks for having me on.
So where to begin, Bob? I mean, there's so much going on, obviously, but let's deal with this puzzlement over why did Rick Gates in the proffer, you know, Queen for a Day, it's called, where you don't lie because the whole deal goes out the window. He lied about a meeting with Dana Rohrabacher back in 2013. This is the Kremlin-friendly Republican congressman out here in Orange County, and risked his whole deal. Why, do you think?
Well, I don't have any insight into what was going on in Gates's mind, obviously, nor do I purport to know what Mueller's people are thinking about. I do know from experience that the decision to plead guilty, to stand up in open court and say, I committed crimes, and to face the specter of significant time in jail, is not an easy one. And it is not at all uncommon for people to waffle back and forth and to have difficulty actually forcing themselves to come clean in it. So this is not a novel problem for prosecutors. It frequently takes some time to get people around to being fully truthful, and that's frankly one of the tactics that defense lawyers will use in cross-examining somebody like this, is point out the number of times that they've lied to law enforcement.
So at this point, what's your sense of the viability of the oversight? And I mean, there have been concerns that foreign intelligence services are becoming increasingly reluctant to share vital intelligence with the U.S. because of the partisanship exhibited by Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Now that you have these dueling memos and all that acrimony, it does feel like at least the House Intelligence Committee oversight is broken. So what does that mean, both in terms of concerns that foreign intelligence services might have and, in general, our own intelligence services sharing information with a committee that was traditionally bipartisan but now is broken down in acrimony?
Well, first of all, I do think, as you indicated, it's important to distinguish between the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees, because while the House Intelligence Committee appears riven by partisanship, that does not appear to be the case on the Senate side, that even where they have differing views, they seem to be able to work together cooperatively. But I think it is there is a real risk that this is going to both impede the process of congressional oversight, which is extremely important, and interfere with our intelligence agencies' ability to get information not only from foreign governments but from potential sources. I mean, after all, if you are somebody who has information that you think may be of value to a to an intelligence inquiry, and you look at how Christopher Steele has been dragged through the mud here, is this something you are going to want to let yourself in for? So I think there's a risk of that. I think that the foreign intelligence agencies are not going to be concerned about the partisanship so much as whether the information is going to be adequately protected from disclosure, which is very important to them. And in terms of the relationship of the intelligence agencies with Congress, there is a statutory requirement that the intelligence agencies keep the Congressional Intelligence Committees fully and currently informed of intelligence activities. And I'm sure they'll continue to do that. But there is a long tradition of very close working relationships between the intelligence agencies and the intelligence committees. I mean, there are representatives of intelligence agencies, at least when I was in the ODNI, representatives of intelligence agencies who would be up several times a day offering briefings and information and to members of the intelligence committee and their staff. And there may be a little less willingness to go the extra mile if there's a concern that the information is not going to be adequately protected from disclosure.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob Litt, who's a former general counsel for the Director of National Intelligence, who also served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division and as Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General at the Department of Justice. He is currently counsel in Morris Foster's National Security and Global Risk and Crisis Management Practices. Your former boss, General James Clapper, mused of the possibility that Donald Trump, that Vladimir Putin could be Donald Trump's case officer. But that aside, what's emerging now from what we're learning about the indictments of or the deal that Gates made and the increasing pressure on Manafort does paint a picture of Manafort as being somebody that could be owned by Putin, or by extension, the oligarch gangster Deripaska, who loaned Manafort a lot of money. And maybe that was a way to get him on the hook. And then, of course, as soon as he became the campaign manager for Donald Trump, apparently the pressure was taken off. And then, of course, they changed the GOP convention platform to be quite Russian-friendly. But then what we're learning from what Gates and Manafort were up to, falsifying loan documents, was that there was a panic set in to pay off Deripaska. It's almost like you're afraid that the mafia is going to come and break your kneecaps. And of course, Deripaska is now suing Manafort and Gates for a missing $20 million. So what do you make of that? I know it's all rather murky, but the idea that a guy that be in hoc to Russian oligarchs close to Putin could end up being the campaign manager for a major American candidate running for president in itself is pretty mind-boggling.
Well, I think that one thing that the events of the last week should have taught us, if we didn't know it already, is that we don't know what Mueller knows and we don't know where Mueller is going. He's conducted this inquiry in an absolutely exemplary manner, and he obviously has a theory of the case in mind. I certainly don't think that anybody can say that the possibility of a collusion or agreement or cooperation between some people in the Trump campaign and some Russians, I don't think anybody can say that has been ruled out yet. There is certainly information and evidence of the sort of thing that you've talked about that warrants further inquiry. But what else Mueller knows and where he's going with it, we'll just have to wait and find out.
But In the broader sense, what's so troubling is that we no longer live in a country where there's a consensus about what is real and what is true. And a big part of the country believes almost anything that Donald Trump says. And he's tweeting out all kinds of strange accusations, even against his own Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, as though Sessions has somehow dropped the ball and not prosecuted Hillary Clinton, who in Trump's latest tweet, he blames for everything. So if Trump's tactic is to distract, which it appears to be, has he not been successful in distracting us from the Russian inquiry by going after the FBI, the DOJ, Hillary Clinton, you name it? And not just doing this, but having a kind of echo chamber in the right-wing press and having a lot of Republican enablers helping him.
I do think you hit on something very important, and that is that we must not lose sight of the fact that whether the people in the Trump campaign were willing cooperators with the Russians or whether they were taken advantage of unwittingly by the Russians, the fact remains that it is absolutely indisputable that the Russians mounted a serious campaign to attempt to influence our election in the interest of hurting Hillary Clinton and helping Donald Trump. Nobody will ever be able to tell whether they had an impact on the election, because by the very nature of this sort of influence campaign, you can't check the number of votes that may have been influenced by it. But it seems to me to present a important and significant question that our democratic institutions so far are failing to address, which is how do we ensure that our elections are not tainted by the efforts of people who are seeking to do us harm?
But that's not on the agenda. I mean, that's the amazing part, that there's no discussion. Sessions himself said that they're not doing anything. And President Trump has never brought it up. So that is an extraordinary in itself, isn't it? That we're not dealing with a problem. And you know, you could cynically interpret that as saying, well, you know, the Russians helped us in 2016, so why not in 2018 and 2020?
Well, again, far be it for me to speculate on what's motivating our president. It seems clear, though, that any action to safeguard our elections is going to have to be taken without any sort of leadership from the president. The Democrats have made some proposals in Congress, and it will be interesting to see if the Congress steps up to the plate and actually takes action, or whether it allows itself to be distracted by this political back and forth about who was colluding with the Russians and witch hunts and so on and so forth. Because, as I said, this is a major problem for our democratic institutions.
So back to the latest from Mueller, then, what do you make then of the role of Representative Dana Rohrabacher? He seems to be in many ways intertwined with this Russia inquiry. He met with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks a while back, and he also met with Michael Flynn in 2016, and of course, he has this reputation for being very Kremlin-friendly. And in an off-the-cuff remark I think it's the congressman from Bakersfield now, who's the deputy head of the House, made in a private meeting with Paul Ryan, that I swear to God, both Putin and Dana Rohrabacher, both Trump and Dana Rohrabacher on, this is Kevin McCarthy quoting him, both Putin and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll. And that, of course, immediately, apparently, Paul Ryan said, well, let's keep that in the family and not talk about it. Now, that's been dismissed as a rumor, but a very credible source, Evan McMullen, the former CIA officer, was there in that meeting and verifies that this happened. So, you know, inquiring minds want to know how deep this goes. Does this trouble you? I mean, I know it troubles your former boss, General Clapper.
Well, I do think that over the years, Congressman Rohrabacher has been somewhat out of step with the rest of our political bodies in terms of his attitude towards Russia. I've read credible press reports that say that the meeting that Page lied about in February was, in fact, a meeting with Rohrabacher. And again, I think I would prefer to sit back and see where, if anywhere, Mueller goes with this, because I have confidence that if there is any wrongdoing there, he's going to uncover it.
Well, but in terms of the memo itself, what's your sense of whether the Democratic memo had the effect of rebutting Nunes? Because first of all, there was a double standard. Nunes was able to put his memo out with Trump's blessing over the objections of the FBI and the DOJ, who wanted sources and methods protected, and they were very cavalier about it. But then they exacted that pressure on this memo that the Democrats put together, which has been redacted, and they held it up, and it was released on Saturday, which is not exactly a strong news day. So already out of the gate, there's a feeling that that the Democratic memo has been disadvantaged, shall we say. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I have two thoughts on that. I'm going to give the Justice Department and the FBI the benefit of the doubt, because reading the redacted version of the Democratic memo, it seems clear to me that that what has been redacted, what's likely left out, probably is considerably operationally sensitive, more so than a lot of the information in the Republican memo. Sorry, a Freudian slip there. And so I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Having said that, it's important to remember that the timing of the release of this memo was dictated by Chairman Nunes. He's the one who decided to release this late Saturday afternoon. And as I think Congressman Schiff said, if you really think that this memo proves your case, you don't release it late in the day on Saturday afternoon. And I think that in itself speaks volumes about the relative persuasive impact of the two memos.
So, but is there, I mean, the idea that the Republicans are turning Carter Page into a hero of the First Amendment, and he's a victim of the deep state, the surveillance state, is pretty laughable, isn't it? I mean, I'm puzzled as to why the Russian spies try to recruit him in the first place. And of course, in FBI transcripts of the wiretapping of these Russian spies, they thought the guy was a greedy jerk, I think, to put it bluntly. But I mean, how could they, Nunes, go to bat for Carter Page as though he's being abused by the system when he's so clearly been in the pocket of the Russians, if not an active spy, useful idiot. Yeah,
that's the important part. They may have characterized Page as an idiot, but that doesn't mean he couldn't be a useful idiot. I mean, the fact of the matter is that spies generally don't have success recruiting people of outstanding probity, intellect, and financial security. People generally, if they're going to betray their country, either wittingly or unwittingly, there's usually a weakness, and spies know how to prey on this. So the fact that they may have characterized Page as an idiot does not say anything really about whether or not they were in fact trying to recruit him. And as for what Nunes is attempting to do by this, I do think that one has to question whether his priority is actually getting to the bottom of Russian interference in the election or protecting the president. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, just in closing, do you have any thoughts on this extraordinary incident that took place in Syria? We know from the recent indictments from Mueller of the Russians that the most prominent one is a guy called Prigozhin, who is referred to as Putin's chef. And he also, along with this troll farm in St. Petersburg that he was running that was interfering in our 2016 election, he also apparently organizes these. I guess you could call him Putin's or Russia's Eric Prince. He runs these kind of mercenary armies, and his army the Wagners just got wiped out by only 12. They attacked a Kurdish base in Syria with 12 U.S. special forces, who then reined in enormous amount of air power. The Russians let this mercenary army attack the Americans without air power, which is pretty strange in itself. So is there something going on there, do you think? Do you think Putin may be hanging out Prigozhin to dry to take the fall for the interference? I mean, why would this happen? These guys just get wiped out. And the Russian press, of course, is not talking about it. But I'm curious to know how something like that could have happened.
I don't know. I think it just emphasizes what an enormously complicated and combustible situation Syria is, with so many actors, with so many different interests who are shifting allegiances and shifting interests, and that it just requires a degree of sensitive diplomacy and careful military work that I hope all sides are capable of maintaining, because while this incident seems to have passed by, which suggests that maybe the Russians were not acting under authority, but while this incident seems to have passed by, the next one may not, and so it just calls on everybody to be extraordinarily careful.
Right, but Russians attacking Americans is something, hardly something you'd brush under the table, and that's the amazing thing, that it's sort of like nobody's, least of all our own president. I mean, you know, Russians attacked a bunch of Americans. That's not a good thing.
No, it's not. I mean, I don't know whether they knew there were Americans there, or they just thought they were attacking Kurdish positions. And certainly, given the outcome, one would hope that they would be sensible enough not to attempt the same sort of thing again. But as I said, in such a complicated situation, accidents are going to happen.
Well, Bob Litt, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob Litt, who's a former general counsel for the Director of National Intelligence, who also served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division and as the Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General at the Department of Justice. He is currently counsel to Morrison & Foerster's National Security and Global Risk and Crisis Management Practices. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking further into the Democratic memo in rebuttal to the Nunes memo, and the extent to which it reflects the total breakdown of an oversight committee that was traditionally bipartisan. But they beg you, wait my name.
I'm at home in the streets of Rome, or just hanging around Lo Chiang Hai. Danger is my logo, espionage and go-go, I'm just digging this American crime. Two deadly agents of a wicked persuasion tried to send me on a permanent vacation. I gave on the slip.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He's the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and The Threat on the Horizon, and his latest book just out is Spy Watching. intelligence accountability in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Locke. And what do you make of the Democratic memo, the rebuttal to the Nunes memo? It was obviously released on Saturday. It was held up for some time. There was a double standard applied. The Nunes memo went out eagerly sent out by the White House without redactions, even over the objections of the FBI and DOJ. But this memo, the Democratic one, was held up and redacted by the FBI and the DOJ, and, as I say, released on a Saturday, perhaps in the hope that nobody would notice. What did you make of it?
Well, I think it's good in a democracy to get as much information out as we can. After all, democracy depends upon an informed citizenry. And now, despite some of the blackouts in these memos because of security reasons, the American people have a chance to look at both of them and come to their own judgment. I personally find the Democratic memo much more compelling, not because of any partisan reason, but because I think it's more closely reasoned and hones closer to the evidence that I've seen out there in the public domain. I think in all this crash of politics on Capitol Hill, particularly in the House Intelligence Committee, which is a shame, because as I've heard you say before, that committee and the Senate counterpart were created to be bipartisan and to deal with intelligence which should be above political issues. But at least these memos are out, and we have a chance to look at them. But as we do, I think we sometimes lose sight of the most important point in this whole discussion, and that is we're trying to find out if the Russians meddled in our 2016 election. That's what the Mueller investigation is all about, and everything else pales in comparison to that. But what you tend to be finding instead is these allegations made that the Democrats are trying to bring Trump into disrepute by attacking him and saying that he was involved in collusion with the Russians. And then you find the Democrats saying that the Republicans are trying to cover this up. I think the truth is that this investigation from Mueller is moving forward, and despite this flurry of memos, we're eventually going to find out the answer to that key question. Did the Russians really try to interfere in our election?
But Donald Trump has successfully, or at least to a degree, distracted the public from the Mueller inquiry and shifted the focus to attacking the FBI and the DOJ and Hillary Clinton, as he did in his tweets over the weekend.
Well, I think that's exactly right.
You know,
and I would agree with you, and I would say the whole purpose of the White House here and their water carrier on Capitol Hill. Mr. Nunes of the House Intelligence Committee, chairman of that committee, the whole purpose is to discredit the Mueller probe and to muddy the waters with respect to whether or not the Russians were involved in manipulating our election. And, of course, one of the big questions here, sort of the elephant in the room, is why is the president and why is his water carrier, Mr. Nunes, so intent on deflecting this investigation and keeping the truth from the American people on exactly what the Russians were doing? And you know, one of the centerpieces in this whole debate in the Republican and Democratic memo and a surrounding discussion is this Carter Page fellow. And if you look at his record, it's a little disquieting. We know that he lived in Russia for a good period of time, from 2004 to 2007. And the FBI, quite a while ago, I mean, long before any of this FISA court request came to light, was already interested in him and wondering what he was doing over there in Russia. And so they looked at him way back in early 2016, long before the FISA court request, and they found some troubling things about his relations with Russians. And so, you know, to say that Carter Page only became a subject later on when the FISA court proceedings were underway is mistaken. The FBI had an interest in him a long time before that, and a long time before the so-called Steele dossier surfaces as well. So I think it's important to keep the chronology in mind here, and the chronology goes back to early 2016 when Page was already under investigation by the FBI, and then we found that by the time we get to March of 2016, the FBI's interviewing page and trying to find out what his relationship was with the Russians. And then July of 2016, the FBI opens its case, and only in September did the Steele dossier come to the attention of the FBI with respect to anything to do with Page. So the FBI has long been interested in him, and they've been carrying out their job. And this is basically a counterintelligence case, Ian, and when someone high up who was a foreign policy advisor to the Trump administration, or for that matter any other administration or to any other campaign, let's say Hillary Clinton, if you think there's a high-level advisor in these campaigns or anywhere in the government who has strong connections to Russian intelligence, the FBI has an obligation in cooperation with the CIA to track that down and try to find out what's going on.
Again, I'm speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He is the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and the Threat on the Horizon, and his latest book just out is Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States. So, Locke, we were just talking with Bob Litt, the former general counsel for the Director of National Intelligence, who mentioned that the Nunes memo and the trashing of the MI6 officer Steele,
yes,
probably sends a pretty negative signal to cooperating allied intelligence services. Is, you know, don't get involved with the Americans, otherwise you just absolutely have your career trashed. And now, of course, he's in hiding and being sued by all kinds of people, the Russians right. included, and costing him a fortune. So I'm sure he's sorry he ever took that opposition research work, first with a Republican hedge fund guy, paid him initially, and then, of course, the Hillary Clinton campaign
right.
subsequently took over the account. So that's one issue. And also, there was also speculation that because of the dysfunction and the partisanship of the House Intelligence Committee, perhaps America's own intelligence agencies are going to be reluctant sharing information with the Congress. So we'll take those one and two. First, is it going to impact cooperation with foreign intelligence services? And two, will our own intelligence services be reluctant to share stuff with people like Devin Nunes?
Well, I think the answer in both cases for those very important questions is yes. And I think we've had a long tradition in this country, and certainly both the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee up until recently have been very careful about keeping the names of people in the intelligence business out of the public domain, because after all, that endangers their lives, and also to make sure that when we have cooperation with other intelligence agencies, we keep any secrets they give to us closely held. This is called intelligence liaison or burden sharing, and it's extremely important because, you know, the world is vast. And the United States, even though we spend a lot of money on intelligence, cannot cover the whole world. So we need to have partnerships in helping us understand what's happening in the four corners of the world. And I think they are reluctant when suddenly all of our intelligence, or much of our intelligence, is being discussed in the public domain. So this is quite harmful to the U.S. intelligence effort. And Ian, you know, I was on the Church Committee back in 1975, and we created the Senate Intelligence Committee, and right after that, the House Intelligence Committee came into view. And the intention back there was to make sure these committees were above politics, to put the national interests first over narrow political interests. And I think for the most part, those committees have done a good job in that regard. We did have the Iran-Contra scandal during the 80s, but otherwise, these two committees have been above politics for the most part and have been very careful about keeping the names of agents closely held. So it's extremely disappointing, to say the least, that Mr. Nunes has taken the House committee off in a far different direction. And, you know, oversight depends on independence and impartiality and the Congress taking a firm and independent stand. And yet we find that Nunes, a lot of the time, is racing down to the White House to get instructions as to how he should conduct himself as chairman of the House Committee. And both the president and Mr. Nunes seem to be involved more in trying to ruin the Mueller investigation than anything else. And that's not good for the American people.
And, of course, the irony is, of course, that Nunes was championed the extension of the FISA court for another 5 years. And yes. the real role of the Intelligence Oversight Committees is to be advocates for the public. And you were in on the beginning when these, as you mentioned, in the Church Committee, when all the dirty laundry of the CIA was being aired publicly. And the whole point of these committees was to stop those kind of abuses that went on in the world of secrecy in the name of the American people, and to have some transparency. And quite recently, as you know, Dianne Feinstein butted heads with the CIA over a minority report on the CIA torture.
That's right.
But Nunes is not doing any of those things. He's actually working as a kind of political agent of a executive branch that...
Well, you know, that's very true, Ian. And we all need to go back from time to time and remember the great genius of the founders of the United States back in 1787. And what they realized was power can be a corrupting influence. I mean, 100 years later, Lord Acton gave that famous expression, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. But even back in 1787, they were worried about that because of George III and the experience they had had with him. So they created a Congress that was supposed to be a standalone and an important check on executive power to make sure that we didn't have a George III coming into fruition in the United States. And we've drifted away from that idea. And Nunes doesn't get it at all. Nunes believes that the nation needs to be run by a strong president, and he has, it seems, disregard almost completely for his own institution. And so we need to return to these founding principles and make sure that Congress is a guardian for the American people and making sure intelligence is used properly. And that's what the Mueller investigation is all about, trying to find out exactly how the Russians have been misusing intelligence to try and disrupt our election, and to see how effective we've been, both in the FBI and the CIA and the other 15 agencies, have been in trying to thwart these Russian efforts. It's a very serious investigation and ought to be way above any political considerations, and yet Mr. Nunes has managed to drag this down into the political gutter.
Well, Locke Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, I thank you, too. Always good talking with you, Ian. All the best to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, one of America's leading experts on the nation's intelligence organizations. He's the Regents Professor of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and served as staff director of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, as well as assistant to the chairman of the Aspen Brown Commission on Intelligence. He's the author of America's Secret Power and the Threat on the Horizon. And his latest book just out is Spy Watching, Intelligence Accountability in the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Holly Shaken, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Holly Shaken.
It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you, Holly. And on Monday, Janus versus AFSCME, as the union, that case is being heard before the Supreme Court. with the new member on the court, Gorsuch, and the expectation is that the union will lose. But by extension, this will have a dramatic effect on the ability of the Democratic Party to be competitive, even in the 2018 midterm elections coming up, because the public employees, the unions, and others, if this ruling goes against AFSCME, the union, then all of the public sector unions, in fact, I don't know how much it's going to affect union movements across even into the private sector, but essentially the ruling, what's at stake is that these unions won't, the members of these unions won't have to pay dues. Is that what it comes down to?
It certainly does. It could be very damaging, in some cases demolishing, for public sector unions, and really damaging for the entire labor movement. The reason is about a half of all union membership today is in the public sector. In the private sector, unions only account for about 6.5% of the workforce. In the public sector, they account for a third of the workforce and about half of all union members nationally. So this is very big news. And as you point out, it could transform American politics. In fact, the backers of this case, a lot of big money has gone into it, really want to weaken progressive voices nationally, and this is meant to do just that.
Well, whether the Democratic Party is progressive or centrist or whatever, that's a subject for another debate. But the long and the short of it is, we have a two-party system, and what this will do, when you put it in the context of Citizens United, which has been a massive gift to the Republican Party, because all kinds of plutocratic money is pouring in, and it's a lot of it is dark money, $861 million poured in at the last minute in the Donald Trump campaign through dark money vehicles from the Mercers and the Kochs and others. So we already know that the Republicans have a financial advantage, but if you take away the Democratic Party's funding, and I don't know what the percentage is, but it's close to 10% of their funding that the Democrats get from these unions, and then on top of that, you have to add the in-kind donations from unions for phone banks and canvassers and people who drive people to the polls, etc. So this is a big deal in terms of basically cutting the Democratic Party off at the knees.
And really weakening the labor movement itself. What exactly is going on here is that, particularly in right-to-work states, you don't have to be a member of a public union. But because the union is the exclusive representative of all workers, you enjoy all benefits. So now you have to pay what's called an agency fee, which doesn't include the political activities of a union, but really covers the collective bargaining costs, which you directly benefit from. What unions argue is that what Janus versus AFSCME is likely to do, if the Supreme Court supports it, is make it very easy and encourage workers effectively to be free riders, meaning to pay nothing and enjoy the benefits of collective bargaining. That means each year fewer and fewer workers may opt to join, and it weakens the collective bargaining more broadly. There's two caveats to this, though, that are very important. Of course, Monday is the oral arguments for the case, not the final decision. It is likely, very likely, that the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, will endorse Janus versus AFSCME, which will be a big blow for unions. But the first caveat is likely, even very likely, is not absolutely positive. We'll get a sense from the kinds of questions that are asked in oral arguments this time around. In several months, we'll actually see the ruling. The details could be important. Second, this is less obvious but critical. Unions have known this is coming for a while, most directly since a 2016 case, which is very similar, Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association, which looked like it was about ready to be decided against unions when Justice Scalia died, and it tied 4-4, and that meant that the current ruling was sustained. So we're in essentially revisiting that. But since then, unions have prepared extensively for the public sector, for the possibility, even the likelihood of this happening. How have they prepared? They've sought to engage their membership much more directly. They've sought to do more education. They've sought to make people aware of the value of the unions, essentially creating unions as a social movement in a much more direct way to confront what takes place on Monday and what takes place when the ruling comes down.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. But of course, Harley, this means that the unions are diverting their resources and attentions away from getting political representation through the Democratic Party, but working on internal building and having to fight this canard that the plutocrats are putting up, the Koch brothers and the Bradley Foundation, who are funding this lawsuit, as they did earlier with the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. They're basically, you know, having to, they're arguing on the First Amendment, the same argument basically for Citizens United, that this is an issue of free speech, that people shouldn't have to pay dues if they don't agree with the political outcomes of the investment that the union makes in politics. So this is not, you know, they are changing their narrative, but they are spending, unions are spending more time now trying to assuage members as opposed to recruit new members.
You're absolutely right about this. No union would have wished this case. This is not trying to make lemonade out of lemons to say that unions have been mobilizing their membership. But in a way, does it divert attention from what they're doing politically and from other areas? Of course. But it also strengthens them as organizations by creating a sense of social movement. And that applies to political campaigns. It applies to community activities and a lot of other things that are going on. So would unions have desired this? Of course not. But in a perverse way, they may come out of it stronger in some areas, although they are likely to lose membership, and the short-term transition could be very damaging.
Well, the AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers, they gave about $26 million to the Democrats in the 2016 election cycle. And as I mentioned, I think it's around 10% of the money that the Democrats get. And that's a significant amount of money. But I think you have to add to that the in-kind efforts of unions in terms of putting people in the field to canvass, knock on doors, drive people to the polls, etc. So it's pretty hard to know. Do you have any idea, Harley, of how important the unions are in terms of the viability of the Democratic Party?
Oh, they're absolutely critical. And you put your finger on it by the second part of what you said. Unions can turn people out. They can, you know, volunteers come out of the labor movement. People who have learned organizational skills come out of the labor movement and can provide real energy and a lot of ideas for campaigns, both electoral campaigns and for broader campaigns on issues like immigration, the minimum wage, et cetera. So if unions are cash-starved and concentrating simply I'm staying alive, it makes things harder. There's another dimension. If this goes through, which at this point appears likely but not certain, then you're likely to see more attacks among unions. This isn't for those hard-line conservatives that are pushing this, for the big money that is so powerfully behind it. This is not meant as the end game. It's meant as a major step towards completely marginalizing unions. And in that sense, we all suffer, because ultimately it's not simply a union or a labor issue. It's unions are core to a democratic society. They provide the checks and balances, and they represent working families, not simply their own members, in all kinds of other ways. If unions are diminished, then those voices are diminished, and democracy itself, in my view, is seriously eroded.
Well, we know that the Bradley Foundation are behind this movement, and it's the Illinois Policy Institute, which is the people that I guess recruited Janus. They do what's called Supreme Court shopping. This is the plaintiff who's arguing that his First Amendment rights are being infringed because of having to give money to his union, which in turn supports Democratic candidates. This Koch brothers, of course, have also given money to the National Right to Work Foundation, and again, the Illinois Policy Institute. The Koch brothers are extremely active on a lot of fronts, as you know, Harley. They're behind this national effort to bring about a constitution convention, which they're close to pulling off. You only need 34 state legislatures to approve it, and they've got 28 so far, and that would open up the entire U.S. Constitution to the Koch brothers' wish list. They could rewrite the entire Constitution. But what they've been busy at, and the Bradleys have been busy at over the years, is these right-to-work states. And where do we stand now in terms of how many states have become right-to-work states? As you know, right-to-work essentially is a union-busting rubric.
Absolutely. And there are far more states right-to-work right now. There's several major campaigns in a number of states, and there are some unusual states that are right to work. The state of Michigan, so associated with unions historically, went right to work, I believe, in 2012. But there's something fascinating here. Union membership took a major hit in Michigan post right to work. But last year, Michigan remained right to work, but union membership increased. So it shows that unions are able to adapt. It is more costly. It takes time and energy and is diversionary, but it may not be by any means the end game. One other case that I'm familiar with in a right-to-work state, Kentucky, is particularly illuminating. The UAW has a number of major factories employing thousands of workers in Kentucky at the Ford plant in Louisville. Right to work, nobody has to join a union. 95% of the workers in the plant are UAW members. So there are some possibilities here, but there are dark days immediately and possibly for quite a period ahead if this ruling goes through in the way that most observers at this point think it will.
But the right-to-work states, as they increase in number, they put the unions on the defensive and again have force them to divert resources to shoring up their membership as opposed to growing. That's the same problem that you have that we discussed earlier, right?
Oh, absolutely. And another thing that, you know, that underscores the point you're making here, the Koch brothers and the Bradley Foundation and others would not be pouring tens of millions of dollars into these campaigns if they didn't feel that unions would be seriously weakened. They viewed this as the shortest, most effective route to weaken unions at the bargaining table and to undermine, even demolish their influence politically. So they're putting their money where their interests are. The point I'm making isn't that this won't be damaging. It's that unions, when they are under this kind of attack, historically have shown real resilience and a lot of innovative strategies. I think it would be premature to write them out. But the game plan is real clear. Tilt politics by starving unions of resources.
But unions have diminished in their percentage of the workforce. You mentioned it's about 6.5% of the private workforce now is unionized. I mean, I don't know what it was in the 50s. I believe it was in like 40% or something.
Pretty close. At peak in the 50s, it was about 35% of the workforce, and it was virtually entirely private sector workforce, and that compares to 6.5% right now. Overall, unions are a bit above 10%, which is about where they were at the beginning of the Great Depression. So it's those numbers are meaningful. Unions punch above their weight politically because they've developed, I think, innovative and effective strategies to mobilize their members. But they are in a position that is precarious. And as I mentioned, it isn't simply unions. Who else speaks for non-union workers in the political process? Who speaks for those who are disenfranchised, for those who are poor, for those who are the most vulnerable to economic shock? So they are a vital voice for working families. Over the years, over the decades, conservatives and Republicans have been adept at painting unions as a special interest. But in the 50s and 60s, where unions were much stronger, particularly as a percent of the workforce, union gains were viewed widely in the United States as gains for all workers. So those who were supervisors at a General Motors plant would often cheer on their union reps, even though they weren't in the union, knowing that if hourly workers got these gains, the company would follow with them as well. And there was a broad notion, if unions won it first, all workers would benefit later. Now, very often when unions make a gain, the reaction of many, given this onslaught over many decades against unions, is, why should they have this if I don't? And of course, that contributes to a downward spiral across the board.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Harley Shaken. I thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.